The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Euro special just before Christmas. We'll give you a handy where are the big European leagues at type pod. No one thought AC Milan would be leading the way at Christmas. Not many had Atleti at the top of La Liga and, well, Bayern Munich are good. We'll have a Messi happiness update as he equals Pelé's goal-scoring record. How's the Pirlo revolution going? And will Schalke ever win a game of football again? There's the Norwegian update that you didn't need, your questions, and of course, Christmas ham times with Sid Lowe. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Hello.
Hello, Max.
Nicky Bandini. Hello.
Good morning.
Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Hi, Max. You've insulted me already. This is a record sort of it's never been this quick. At some point, but never.
It's like Milan's goal.
It's also
less than 6 seconds.
It may be the first pod where the first person to be insulted isn't Barry. So, you know, that's the Christmas spirit right there.
Fair enough.
And completing the lineup, Sid Lowe. Hi, Sid.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm excellent. Thanks very much. First question.
Before we crack on with any Euro football chat, we're here on Zoom. I'm looking at Sid in the bottom right-hand corner of my screen. And above his head appears to be a light shade that's covered in barbed wire. I'm curious to know what's going on
it
there.
It does look like it's covered in barbed wire, but it's actually made of driftwood. So it's pieces of driftwood wired together.
Do you have is your house like the Forest Green planned stadium? It's all ecological. You have got nothing.
No. To my enormous shame, given that this is a Guardian podcast, I'm really quite rubbish at that sort of stuff, at recycling things. This is a supposedly stylish piece of driftwood rather than a very environmentally friendly piece of driftwood.
Your house and your laptop is fueled with diesel. You're an evil man, Sid Lowe.
I know.
Can I ask what's happening with winter breaks? Obviously, most European leagues stop for ages. I just wondered what's the state of play? Has everything stopped? Sid, we'll start with you in Spain.
Spain almost always does. And there's always discussions about whether or not it should and whether they should follow the English example, to the extent that Spain refer to that round of games, even in Spanish, as Boxing Day, because it's seen as a British thing. This year, obviously, because of the pandemic, they've been trying to squeeze games in, but also not force them to play on Christmas Day. So what they've done is what would have been a round of games, obviously, on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which obviously, of course, is Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and the day after. They've wedged them in today and tomorrow, get it done, give them a couple of days off, and then wedge another round of games in on, I think it's on the Tuesday afterwards. And so there's an extra round of games at Christmas, but not kind of a Christmas program as such.
Delivery there for Bandini, or somebody just did something very bad to Nicky's dog. So let's go to Lars, who's representing the Bundesliga today. What's the winter break situation over there?
It's a lot shorter than usual. It's usually a sort of a 3 week thing thereabouts, and this time they're going to be back playing on January the 2nd. So there is a short break, but it's shorter than usual, and it's not something everyone's super happy about. But it's a necessity. I mean, usually they all sort of fly off to Marbella or Doha or something to recharge the batteries, and it's not quite the same scope for, you know, having almost like a second preseason in the middle of the season. It's sometimes very, very, very good for teams. You know, if you've changed your manager or if something's not going right, you get an opportunity to sort of go back and look at the team and maybe change some things. Don't really have that chance this season, which is not very good, but it's just the way that has to be.
Nicky, we've had more input from your dog the news so far, so let's write
don't
that.
Don't rule out more because it's Christmas, so there might be more packages coming. So like Spain, Italy tried the Boxing Day thing briefly, and they called it Boxing Day, and they thought, we'll give it a go, and they didn't like it. So we're back to Christmas being a cutoff point. It's a mix of things. I think Italy is often a bit slower to any sort of change. And so instinctively, people like to go back to what they know and what they're comfortable with. I think there's probably a bigger weight given to religious considerations in Italy and the fact that Christmas is taken a bit more seriously from a religious standpoint, perhaps, than is here. Seriously is a bad word, but I couldn't think of a better one. You know what I mean. Catholicism is prominent in the culture. And I think just also some elements of scheduling worked better for giving people this sort of break around what are national holidays and allowing to come back in the new year. It's one of those situations where I can imagine in another few years we might yet change back again, but certainly the idea of having some Christmas break is pretty fixed. And I think that this year of all years, you're sort of hearing it and seeing it from the managers and players that they are clinging on with their nails at this point for this winter break, even though it's a short one, and just desperate to have this sort of brief respite and pause from what's been a really crazy calendar.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who watched Burnley Wolves yesterday at 5:30, I know exactly how they feel. Sid, you're gonna follow on from that.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just that from the Spanish point of view, there's always been a Christmas break. It's been longer or shorter depending on the years and how compact the schedule is and so on. But what has happened in the last few years is that because there's been no football over Christmas, English football has kind of stepped into the void. So there's this kind of tradition almost, I call it a tradition, that's massively overblown. But the last 4 or 5 years, there's been this kind of enjoyment in Spain of the Boxing Day fixtures. So for 3 or 4 days, while there's no Spanish football on, there's some English games for people to watch, and everyone says, oh, isn't this great? Now, of course, there's two ways of looking at this, and both of them lead more or less to the same thing. One is, isn't this great? So people think, well, wouldn't it be great in Spain? And the other, from the league's point of view here, is, bloody hell, hang on a minute. We're allowing the Premier League to effectively steal our own natural customers because we're giving them football when we're not giving them football. We're giving them English football. And so La Liga has been really keen to try and do this and haven't done it yet, to try and do some sort of Christmas programme. The problem, and it goes back to what Nicky's saying, is that, yeah, but you can't just invent a tradition. You can try it and it might work, but you can't just invent a tradition. And of course, one of the reasons why the Boxing Day fixtures are so supposedly special in England and why that cramming of games for England is because people will go to the games. People will make a thing of it. It will feel like an event that involves everyone. Whereas I think there's still a slight feeling in Spain that if we started doing this, we'd be actually imposing these games on people rather than necessarily, you know, involving people in these games.
All right, we're going to go through each of the major European leagues, league by league, starting for no particular reason with Spain, Sid. Doesn't mean you get to go to sleep at the end of part one.
Oh, no? Okay.
So, look, Atleti lead the way. Did you expect that? How well are they playing at the moment?
Did I expect that? I think at the very start of the season, probably not. But I think, you know, you always anticipate that they have a good enough team that they can compete. And last year, I think one of the big frustrations for them wasn't so much that they didn't win the league, as that they never really were in a position to have won the league. This year feels different. And 3 or 4 weeks ago, I'd have said much more of an Atletico chance than now, because Madrid and Barcelona were playing so badly. Barcelona is still a kind of erratic, but Madrid are starting to really find their feet now. So there's a sense that it's two teams probably who are going to compete for the title this year. But Atletico are good enough. And how are they playing? Well, really well, apart from the game against Real Madrid, apart from the derby, when they didn't play well at all. Partly because Madrid were very good, partly because they got things wrong. So I think if you look at them now, you still think, well, they're really reliable. It's just that one game that changes everything. They are now level on points with Real Madrid at the top, although Atletico have played 2 games fewer. So in virtual terms, I suppose you could argue they're 6 points clear, but then, of course, we can't necessarily trust them to win those 2 games.
And how Simeone-y are they these days? Has their style changed?
Yeah, well, I think this is one of the reasons why we've looked at them differently this year, because they have shifted in style a little bit. And in a way, maybe this was part of their problem against Real Madrid. They've shifted in style in that they have a lot more of the ball. They play a little bit higher up the pitch. They accumulate much more people around the opposition penalty area. And Simeone himself has said that this has been conditioned. I mean, it's partly was happening a little bit last year, but they had this kind of evolution into this slightly more open thing and then kind of slightly didn't believe in it or didn't trust in themselves and backed off again. But this year, Simeone says that it's been conditioned almost entirely by Luis Suarez. Now, obviously, you can read this as a really positive thing, or you can read it as a really negative thing, because what Simeone is essentially saying is that Suarez is brilliant in the area. Suarez is brilliant if he has people around him, but you can't play that long ball game to Suarez. You try and get Suarez to run beyond someone and he just can't do it anymore. And so you can't look to play on the counter-attack with Suarez. You can't look to stretch the game and have one man sort of as an island up front. I mean, Suarez can do that for you if the job is to bring the ball down and bring others into play, but he can't do that if it's running beyond people. You know, you watch him sometimes and you know, he looks like a man who is well into in his 30s and has bad knees, which of course is exactly what he is. But when they're close to the penalty area, he's really, really decisive. He scored 7 league goals already this year. And of course, the reason why I say that can be problematic is all the way through the season, we're saying this is a really good Atletico side. They're much better to watch. They play hard at the pitch. They've got more variety to them than before. This shows that they're a really good team. Then they played Real Madrid, when because of the quality of Real Madrid, because of the way that Real Madrid played, Atletico weren't able to find a way out. So they did start playing that long ball to Suarez, which is a complete waste of time. And so on that game, we saw a vulnerability that I think we probably hadn't seen in the previous 10. So I don't know if that means we might see a slight evolution back, and it might mean that we see Diego Costa start playing a little bit. Did you hear Costa at the weekend, by the way? I really enjoyed Costa's post-match interview. Costa's been out for a while because he's had thrombosis. We thought that this might be really serious, that he might be out for a very long time as a side effect of having had coronavirus and so on. He came back, which was obviously really good news. He comes on and he dives, but bluntly, he dives and wins a penalty and scores a penalty. So he's very pleased. And after the game, he's asked, you know, you finally came back, well played, all the rest of the normal sort of questions. Then he's asked about Suarez. He says, how good is Luis Suarez, who scored 2 today, got 7 league goals, makes a real difference to your team. And he said, yeah, that bastard didn't score when I was away. As soon as I get back, he goes and gets 2.
You mentioned there, Sid, that you know, because of the way Real Madrid play and the quality that they have, that Atleti couldn't play necessarily the way they wanted to. But I'm sure the last time we spoke, the questions were, are Real Madrid any good? And do they have any quality? And is Zidane for the chop? It doesn't seem that long ago. I mean, I know they're always a week away from a crisis, Real Madrid.
And I think we said even then, didn't we, that here they were in a position where genuinely they had 3 games in a week, away at Sevilla, against Borussia Mönchengladbach in the Champions League, and at home against Atletico Madrid. And had they lost at Sevilla and against Atletico Madrid and to Borussia Mönchengladbach, which at that stage, by the way, looked really plausible because they were playing so badly, then their season would have been effectively over. They would have been what they've been. They would have been, I think, it could have been as many as 12 points behind Atletico Madrid with a game in hand, with Atletico having a game in hand and out of the Champions League at the group stage for the first time ever. So this really was crisis time. And yet at the same time, I think deep down we all thought, yeah, but they'll win all 3. And that's what happened. And not only did they win all 3, not so much the Sevilla game, but the Borussia Mönchengladbach game and the Atletico Madrid game, they were very, very good indeed. And Zidane has turned to the old guard, and Modric and Kroos and Benzema have been fabulous over the last 3 or 4 games.
This is sort of picking up off that, but without, hope it's not too navel-gazing, but the Guardian's top 100, the first tranche is out. And I think Modric is down at 71, Eden Hazard's at 83, it's in that ballpark. I was just wondering if you sort of saw those and in what you thought about them, and whether you think that's fair even given the year it's been.
Shall we do a bit more navel gazing? If you read the little bit of text that I put in for the Modric thing, I think you'll get a sense of what my view on that was, which is Modric has fallen in that list, I think, 71 places in 2 years. And I think I say something along the lines of that suggests a massive decline, which isn't really the case. And it's partly not the case because he probably, certainly in terms of domestic form, shouldn't have been first a couple of years ago and absolutely shouldn't be 71st now. But of course, what happened was he had an amazing World Cup, which of course bolstered him in a season where actually domestically he wasn't that good. And there has been a bit of a tail off since then. Bear in mind that he's 35. He didn't play really well for the first half of last season until lockdown. Fede Valverde played ahead of him and Madrid had an energy that they hadn't had before. And you actually, to be honest, you thought maybe this is the beginning of the end for Modric. Modric came back from lockdown and was brilliant. Started this season a little bit doubtfully, but the last 3 or 4 games has just been off the scale. Brilliant. And so that's the answer. Very briefly, by the way, you mentioned Hazard there. Hazard shouldn't be in the list at all. I mean, he basically hasn't played for a year.
Here's a question from Elliot. After Lionel Messi scored his Pelé equaling goal this week, who is better, Messi or Ronaldo? No. but look, tell us about Messi. He equaled Pelé's record, 643 goals for a single club. But, you know, in a draw with Valencia, what's the Messi happiness scale at the moment?
Well, he's actually done an interview with a guy called Jordi Evole, who does a program called Salvados, and there's lots of very in-depth, very long interview-driven kind of, I suppose you could call them mini documentaries, which will be released, I think, on the 28th or 29th of December. Everyone's got, of course, wait and see if he says anything big. I suspect that what he'll actually say is something to try and keep things calm for now. There's been a couple of little advanced snippets of him saying, well, at the start of the season, everything that happened this summer was kind of, you know, was carried into the season a bit, but I feel better now and I feel happy and motivated. But of course, the big thing is that from the 1st of January, he can legally negotiate with whoever he likes. Now, in a way, that's irrelevant because we all know that players are negotiating anyway, whether they can legally do it or not. But he hasn't committed his future to Barcelona. There's presidential elections on the 24th of January, which may or may not make a difference. I suspect it won't. I suspect his decision isn't going to be driven by who the president is. And to be honest with you, I mean, no one knows yet what he's going to say, but I'd be surprised if he's still here next year.
Do you think it would be easier for whoever replaces Koeman, if we presume Koeman's a dead man walking, if Messi had already gone?
Yes. And I think Koeman will never admit this, but I suspect Koeman in the summer would have probably felt like that might have helped as well. Not because it's any problem with Messi, but because if you're a manager who's just lost Messi, first of all, you buy yourself the time. So, well, how was I supposed to do it in a post-Messi era? You know, I don't have this cheat code that everyone else has had all of these years. And secondly, you can construct something that doesn't need to be constructed around him. Now, obviously, in an ideal world, you get a manager who can construct a team and has the players to construct a team that has Messi in it, plays to him, but not solely to him, and is brilliant with him. That's the ideal solution, because Messi is still better than anyone. I mean, there's no getting away from that. And Messi is still carrying a huge amount of responsibility for Barcelona, which I must admit, I don't think is good for him either. You know, I can understand him wanting to get out.
Sid, can I ask you about Celta Vigo and why they're the most exciting team in Spain at the moment?
Because they've suddenly gone a little bit wild. They sat their manager, Oscar García, and they brought in Chacho Caudet, who's an Argentinian, who actually played for them for 10 games, I think it was, or 11 games back in 2002. And he came in and he was top of the table, actually, with Internacional in Porto Alegre in Brazil, although he's Argentinian. And he came in and essentially said to the players, right, the diagnosis is more or less the same as the diagnosis of the previous manager. The previous manager's diagnosis was, this team's got lots of very nice players in it. We play some quite nice football, but we're incredibly weak defensively. So I need to organise a defence. I need to get us to play a bit deep. We can't be quite so open because we'll get in trouble if we do this. He comes in and I think the mentality is, we've got lots of really nice players. We're really good attackers. We're not very good at defending. So, well, let's attack then. Let's go for it. And sort of threw everyone forward. Now, except for one thing, he leaves a deep midfielder and the two centre-backs a long way adrift of everybody else. But the rest of them kind of go for it. He comes in and he hasn't officially got his papers. And obviously, this is for the sake of my argument and, you know, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So his first game is away at Sevilla. He hasn't got his papers. He's not officially the manager, but he has coached them that week. They lose 4-2 away at the Pith one. So he scored a couple of goals. It's quite exciting, but they've been beaten. Since then, and he's had his paperwork, he's been in charge officially for four games. He's won all four of them, plus a cup game, 5-0. And those four have been a 3-1, a 2-0, a 4-0, a 2-0, and a 5-0. And you suddenly think, where has this come from? And it's just been, you know, he's had five games in charge. They've not lost any of them. Since his arrival, official arrival, we're taking out the Seville game, they're the only team in Spain to have won all four games. They've scored more goals than anyone else. They've conceded fewer goals than anyone else. And they're great fun to watch, not least because he's done what actually, in fairness, everyone does, but kind of more so, which is completely release Iago Aspas. And Aspas is just Aspas is the best Spanish player there is at the moment.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, Lars Sivertsen's Bundesliga Rundfunk.
Pardon?
That's what it is.
Is that a real word?
Yeah.
It's the German word for broadcasting.
Rundfunk.
I love it.
Oh, you just put an N in there that I hadn't heard the first time. Funk. It was
all right. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So then, Lars, the Bundesliga. And we've got to start with a pretty sort of disappointing story, really, which is Borussia Mönchengladbach's Marcus Thuram spitting in the face of the Hoffenheim defender Stefan Posch, which is disgusting anyway, but currently it's even worse.
Yes, it's not good. Odd one, this. He has apologised both publicly and to the sporting director of Gladbach, and the apology is weird because he doesn't. It's not a non-apology apology, but in a way it is. He does certainly come across as taking full responsibility for what happened, but he does insist that he didn't mean to spit, that it's just something that happened whilst he was swearing at the player in French. Now, I don't spend a lot of time swearing in French, maybe it's just inherently you're very close to spitting when you're doing that. I don't think that's true.
I mean, if you were swearing at someone in Welsh, this would be probably a little bit more.
Maybe,
legal,
yeah.
Right?
No, if you look at the images, it's incredibly hard to square the pictures with the idea that he didn't mean to spit. He has apologized, and I find it's a very strange apology because it's not a full sort of non-apology apology, but it is kind of that because he has acknowledged that what he did was wrong, but he does insist that he didn't mean to spit, which I find incredibly hard to square with the images of him unleashing spittle towards the opponent, Posh. And he insists he was just swearing at him in French, which I'm not sure. Maybe that's what happens when you swear in French, but I don't think so. But he has been banned for 5 games. He's been fined the equivalent of a month's wages. And the sporting director, Max Eberl at Gladbach, has spoken, you know, in the way clubs do, saying that, you know, this is not in his character at all. And which it probably isn't, but again, the pictures kind of don't lie about these things. It's a very nasty episode, and yeah, he's been banned for a few games now, and rightly so.
I mean, reading quite a lot about this, people saying that it really is out of character, and you know, he's not that kind of player is not an excuse, is it at all?
He doesn't come across at all, no.
No, but I mean, and it is completely unconnected. Right. And there is no way to connect this to the fact, you know, he was the first guy to take a knee, I believe, after the death of George Floyd. But it was made connected by Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, who on TV afterwards came up with this totally ridiculous sort of hypothetical situation, saying had Stefan Posch spat at him, it would be a race debate. And it's just... You know, I don't know much about Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, but it's just completely unhelpful thing to say in his position.
Yeah, that was. I mean, there's not a lot more to say about that, except there's a bit of a rogue take in a bit of an odd moment where, whilst discussing this on television, Rummenigge made the suggestion that if it had been the other way, it would have been talking about some sort of race incident, which we very obviously wouldn't. And he is a man who's not a stranger to sort of... I mean, at his age, maybe he does yoga. He seems very good at shoving his foot square into his mouth, which is like... it's a hard thing to do at his age, but he seems very good at it. That was lamentable. But I think it's worth reading sort of a the apology that appeared in social media from Thuram, where he said, "Today, something that took place that is not in my character and must never happen. I reacted to an opponent in a wrong way and something occurred accidentally and not intentionally. I apologize to everyone, to Stefan Posch, my opponents, my teammates, my family, and to all those who saw my reaction. Of course, I accept all the consequences of my gesture." So it's a weird sort of halfway house between a full apology and the dreaded non-apology apology.
Let's go on the pitch then. Bayern are top of the Bundesliga. Who would have thought it? Lewandowski. You mentioned the Guardian top 100. It'd be fascinating to see how high up Lewandowski and a lot of the Bayern players will be given the season that they had, even though, you know, Hansi Flick didn't win Coach of the Year, much to Jose's disappointment. But how well are they playing at the moment?
So this is the thing. They're not actually playing that well, which is why this was an interesting game. It wasn't a formality at all. I mean, Bayern have recently dropped points to Werder Bremen. They've dropped points to RB Leipzig, which maybe not such a crime, but they dropped points to Union Berlin. And they've been really missing Josh Kimmich. And we've already mentioned on the pod, I mean, the issue for these high-pressing teams in this season, I think Bayern are an excellent case of that. I mean, in addition to being absolutely bloody brilliant, they've also been the most sort of intensive pressing side in Germany this year. And the stats bear this out. They restrict the opponents and the number of passes they play and all this sort of stuff. They run relentlessly. And that's just a really hard thing to do this season because there are so many games. And there was no like break in the summer, nor preseason. And they have, I know there might be a bit of a confirmation bias because it's a very logical theory, but they have looked a bit tired recently. They have looked like a team who maybe could do with this winter break, albeit a short one. And then you came up in this sort of quite pivotal week because they've dropped a few points where they played first against Wolfsburg, who were undefeated going into their game against Bayern. Now, Wolfsburg are not a great side, but it's, you know, that saying of in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. Like Wolfsburg, like in the land of the Bundesliga, a team that can actually defend will do quite well. So Wolfsburg, not fantastic, but they're quite well-organized and quite rugged and not necessarily an easy team to play against. Bayern beat them. And then they came up against Leverkusen, who were unbeaten, top of the league, and it looked like they could be the real deal. Very energetic, exciting team. And Leverkusen Leverkusen took the lead. Fantastic volley from Patrick Schick. And Leverkusen had their chances either way in this one. Lewandowski got an equaliser. We had the slightly odd spectacle of Leroy Sané being subbed on and then being subbed off again later in the game, which is not ideal. And but later in injury time, Lewandowski got the winner. And we can be flippant and say, well, of course, Bayern, they always win in the end. But this is definitely one of those moments where they had to show just the class in terms of technical ability, yes, but also the extraordinary mentality that this group of players has in finding a winner under pretty difficult circumstances.
We haven't mentioned on this pod Lucien Favre getting sacked as the Dortmund manager. What did you make of that? Was it a surprise at all?
It was pretty inevitable. I mean, I think it's something we've been speaking about for so long, about how he never seemed a very good fit for that group of players. He's sort of scholarly figure, you know. He comes across as a nice guy and a very intelligent football guy, but his way of playing is a little bit circumspect, and there's a bit of a cultural clash there with how Dortmund see themselves as a club and how they want to play their football. And whether he was the guy to push them over the edge and maybe really take the fight to Bayern, it just didn't seem like it. Now, that team has problems that aren't going to be fixed overnight, but they have a situation with Favre where, you know, his contract was expiring after the end of the season, and there was really no serious suggestion of that being renewed. I don't think anyone thought that was ever going to happen. And so when this season also is in danger of collapsing, they had that calamitous defeat to Stuttgart with players coming out sort of almost blaming each other indirectly. You know, it was a sense that things were falling apart and there was no sense continuing with this. But of course, they lost again at the weekend against Union with the young talent Moukoko scoring his first goal at 16 years of age and 28 days, I believe. So that was the big story for them, of course. But then they conceded two goals from set pieces. And it's worth Mats Hummels again was quite furious after the game, saying that this is scathing, actually, from a player coming out saying, sometimes these flicked on corners cannot be defended at the near post, and then you have to track your man at the second post. We have a clear man marking system in place, yet their strongest aerial threat was left wide open with 10 meters of space. For me, it's inconceivable how that can happen. We're doing the damage to ourselves, said their chief center half. So that's quite sort of tells you something about the sort of harmony in the squad there, when the sort of senior players are throwing colleagues under the bus in that manner. So things are not great at Dortmund, and that's certainly a team that needs a break, if not for physical reasons, but they need to have a big reset so they can attack the second half of the season and make sure they make the Champions League.
Lars, who would win in a football match between Schalke and Sheffield United?
Wow. Ooh, I'd favour Sheffield United, I have to say. I mean, Sheffield at least are kind of putting up a fight a little bit. I mean, they got that point at Brighton and they were decent against United, but Schalke just looked completely bereft, good lord. They've not won since the 17th of January, which makes it 29 games without a win. The record is 31. That was Tasmania Berlin from 1966, which is kind of it's a funny story. It's worth looking up. I'm not going to go through it here, but Tasmania...
It's a great name of a football team.
Okay, the short version is... Hertha Berlin, which was the Berlin region's representative in the National Bundesliga, got kind of kicked out for economic irregularities. So they needed another team from Berlin to play in the league. Now, the team that finished top of the regional league had failed in the playoffs, so they didn't feel it was right for them to take that place. The team that finished second in the regional league didn't want to, so it fell to the third place team, Tasmania Berlin, who on pretty short notice was kind of thrown into the National League ahead of the 1965-66 season. And they were so bad, like they set all the records for ineptitude that still stand, like the fewest wins, most goals conceded, all of this, and they went 31 games without a win. Schalke are now threatening this all-time low by just being completely unable to do anything. They just now sacked Manuel Baum after just 10 games, who of course came in after David Wagner was sacked earlier in the season. They brought back Huub Stevens for a fourth spell at the club. He was successful with them sort of back in the late 90s and was voted, or when they awarded him coach of the century. It was very much the last century. And he's been back a couple of times as a sort of firefighter since then. He's very much a back to basics manager. Now, they played Bielefeld this weekend, possibly the worst team in the league on paper, certainly. The team that produced the lowest XG in the league and have the second highest XG against, behind Schalke, of course. So it's the one team you think they can beat. But of course, they didn't. They lost again. Huub Stevens has said, well, it's a mental blockage, which is probably true. young Welshman Rabbi Matondo, I think he was speaking to TalkSport the other week, and one of the things he said, they couldn't quite believe that they were in that much trouble given some of the players they have, which is true, but maybe that's part of the problem. It's one of the cases of there are decent players in the squad. Young Ozan Kabak, I think we got a question about him from the listeners before this. You know, how can he be in this terrible team? Because he's a very highly rated young Turkish defender who's being tracked by some big clubs, and he is, but you know, they're struggling. Suat Serdar's a good midfielder. Salif Sané has been a good defender in the past. And they have some guys like Amine Harit, who's been suspended for showing disrespect to the coach, you know, Nabil Bentaleb, who's been sort of announced that he'll be sold by the summer of 2021 at the latest, is what the club said, and he's been told to train on his own until further notice. So they have a collection of players who are either not very good or some players who are quite good but who clearly don't want to be there. I think Sebastian Rudi is a good example. He's out on loan on Hoffenheim, but he's an example of what's gone wrong for this club. I mean, he was signed from Bayern in 2018 for 16 million euros. According to Bild, he's on 6 million euros a year, so over 100,000 euros a week. He's got 29 caps for Germany, but he just never fit in at Schalke and just never could perform there. Last season, went out on loan to Hoffenheim, was very public about not wanting to come back, but this summer they found him very hard to sell because of COVID and all the whole thing. So he eventually started the season with Schalke and playing two games at right back, and he's not a right back, and it's just this farcical situation. They did manage to send him out on loan against Hoffenheim, but it's just this example of... This is the club who have spent a lot of money over the years on players who, for various reasons, just haven't worked out. And they now find themselves in this incredible hole. They can't get results. They keep changing managers. They've got debts of 200, 250 million euros that they're taking. And it's almost certain to go down now. The club was, I think, most commonly accepted to have the third biggest fan base in Germany. They're heading down with this terrible financial situation and a bunch of players who are either no good or decent but don't want to be there. It's really a dreadful situation. And I don't think Huub Stevens is going to stick around. I think this was just he was coming in to do the last, do a couple of games for them now. But even if he does stick around, it's hard to imagine how anyone can salvage this. It's a dreadful situation.
I mean, what sort of club would you compare them to? I mean, is this like Arsenal going down, or not that, you know, what West Ham or what?
It's I mean, they have, like I said, third biggest fan base in the country, I think it's fair to say, behind Bayern and Dortmund. And they've been this sort of perennially underachieving sort of sleeping giant for a long time now, who have just gone from being underachievers to just a complete disaster zone. And are in just a complete death spiral now. So they are one of the biggest clubs in the country, and it seems inevitable that they're going down now.
Is there anything else we should come to you on, Lars, before we end the Rundfunk and head to Italy?
If we've got time, I mean, it's worth mentioning that the Hertha Berlin lost again and are in a very bad position in the league now. They're just a couple of points above the drop zone. Now, this is, again, I mentioned this because Hertha, you might not be aware, they had the highest net spend in Germany last season. They spent some more money this summer, so they've about 100 million euro of net spend over the last 2 years. Because they have this investor, Lars Windhorst, who's come in and is willing to spend some money to try to turn the Berlin club into a big club, the big city club, as they want to be. And a lot of the signings they've made are sort of okay in isolation, but it doesn't quite seem to hang together. Now, last season they brought in Bruno Labbadia to steady the ship after a disastrous period with Jürgen Klinsmann at the helm. Now, Labbadia is his eighth Bundesliga club. He's one of those guys who sort of, you know, is on the merry-go-round, and he can stabilize a club, and he did, but it's not looking good this season. What I wanted to mention was, again, an interesting case of people being quite savage in the interviews in Germany. I wonder if there is a little bit of a culture for maybe being a bit forthright in what you say in the press there than it is here in England, because you had a coach who had a really square go at his striker, Matias Cunha, a Brazilian, who's not bad. I just want to read the quotes. We could have chosen to take him off last time against Mainz, but choose not to. Today we decided to do it because he was abysmal in the first half. He's still a young player at 21, but something has to change immediately. It's unacceptable. He let himself and his team down with his performance. It's very rare that I do something like this, but I'll say it honestly, I am totally offended. which is not something you generally hear.
That's
coaches
brutal.
Yeah, and the player has responded in social media, and I want to read the post. Hello, my Hertha fans. I know today it wasn't a good day for us. There are people who talk a lot, but I really play for you, for our Hertha, and for those who really want to help. I will improve and give you back Cunha.
Great.
So I mean, that's an interesting situation.
What was that last? Was that his name at the end?
Yeah. He said, "I will give you back," and then Cunha in capital letters. That's like me saying, like, I've had a bit of a rubbish pod today, but like, next time I'm on, I'll give you back Sivertsen. Like, I mean, this is very strange.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, Serie A with Nicky. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Nicky, Serie A. Last time we chatted about Serie A, there was this COVID controversy at Lazio, wasn't it? What happened with that? Is that still ongoing or is it all... I mean, COVID hasn't blown over. I'm totally aware of that in my current tier, but how's that situation?
Yeah, this will drag on. It won't be a quick resolution. There's certainly nothing has come down in terms of implications for the club as yet. But this is an investigation that's being led by local authorities, and it may be a while yet before we have some sort of final verdict out of it.
Right, fine. So AC Milan lead the way. Where did you think they'd be at Christmas?
That's a good question. I did record a preview in which I was sort of, I was the one who put forward the idea of, are they a dark horse? Because of the fact that after the COVID interruption last season, they didn't lose a game and they still haven't lost a game. They've now gone 25 matches in Serie A without a defeat. Some of the numbers are frankly pretty extraordinary. They've scored at least two goals in their last 15 matches, which is every game this season and taking you back to last season. Now, everyone loves to zoom in on Ibrahimovic. Indeed, there was a piece on The Guardian over the weekend which was quoting Mino Raiola saying he's 90% of that team right now. And look, I'm definitely not going to play down Ibra's impact. I think what he's done for the club in a global sense is huge. But the fact is, this team scores goals whether he's there or whether he's not, because he hasn't been there lately. They have dropped a few points. They've had a couple of draws back to back in games you wouldn't necessarily expect it. But those weren't games where it was just Ibrahimovic missing. They were games when they were missing Ismaïl Benacer, who I think has been very possibly the best midfielder in Serie A this season. Him and Frank Kessié, the pair of them, have definitely been the best tandem so far this season. They've been missing Simon Kjær at the back, who was an unlikely sort of emergence, I think, in this sort of latter part of his career, but has been really, really important to their defence. They've been missing Ante Rebic this weekend as well. So they've been doing without all sorts of players. And the fact that they are still top one game from Christmas, they could still very well lose it before Christmas because their last game of the year is against Lazio. But the fact they're still there is hugely impressive. You think the team they started at the weekend against Sassuolo, who are no pushovers this season. They've sort of been the Atalanta story, the new fairy tale overachievers. They started this game without all those players I mentioned, with an average age of, I think, 22 years and 3 months. And they went and won pretty comfortably in the end, even though 2-1 doesn't look comfortable. They were 2-0 up until the 89th minute. I think it's hugely impressive. I think Stefano Pioli is working miracles there. Whether or not they can sustain it all the way to the end of the season, we'll see. And I think I mentioned earlier in the podcast that some managers are very openly like clicking on now for this winter break. I think given the absences and with Kessié picking up a suspension as well for this last game, Milan perhaps as much as anyone are hanging on for this break and this chance to recuperate a little bit.
And they scored the quickest ever goal in Serie A history.
They'd seen what they thought was a vulnerability in Sassuolo and they attacked it with Calhanoglu receiving the kickoff, sprinting straight forward, drawing three players to him and then just playing this simple ball inside the left channel for Leao, who's attacking down the wing. And he just slices straight between the centre-back and the full-back and scores. And it was just so easy. And I think it's something that when I see something like that, of course, the defending was bad, but I'm almost surprised we don't see more set plays from kickoff like that because wow. This was, again, it was a completely scripted play and it worked.
I agree with you, Nicky, that I'm surprised we don't see more of it. But this sort of takes me back to the Jimbo days when he would stress that, you know, if an Italian side goes 3-0 up, you sort of take your foot off the gas. You don't humiliate your opponents. This strikes me as the kind of thing Italians might consider poor form. Was there any suggestion of that?
Not at all, no. Because this is good tactical planning, which Italians adore. That's one of the first things that Italians are proud about, is how good their managers are at out-scheming people. It's kind of, I mean, look, Italian football has changed a lot from some of those cliches. And I think Atalanta are a good example of a team who have been quite content to run up the score recently, actually. So those ideas don't necessarily hold like they used to. But in general, and certainly going back to the writings of Gianni Brera, who's held up as this great influence on the way Italians think about their own football, because he's a famous journalist. He was sort of...
The Italian Jonathan Wilson.
Maybe. But his whole shtick, which was a bit out there, was that, look, Italians basically aren't physically as impressive as some other nations, but we're cleverer. And so this is being clever.
Nicky, while we're on Milan, before you move on, I think it's really fun that we're talking about a Milan team and we're talking about the youth. I mean, for so long, the retirement home of European football, it's such a youthful and exciting group there. And I think you know what's coming. I'm not going to hide my Nordic bias here. How exciting is Jens-Petter Hauge from a scale from 1 to 20? And is he the most exciting thing ever? I think he might be.
He's exciting. I don't know. On your scale of 1 to 20, exactly where I'd put him. Because I think there's a lot of players in that team I'm really excited about. And as I say, if you ask me what I think is most impressive about this Milan team, for me, it's still when they're both there, which again, they won't be on Wednesday. It's still Frank Kessié and Ismaël Bennacer. I think Kessié's got the oldest head on his shoulders, and Bennacer has just been a monster in front of that defence for last season. But yes, Hauge is another element. And there's so many in this team at the moment. I think that's kind of really the thing that I would stress, without wanting to not just put it all on your Norwegian superstar, Lars. I think what I would stress about Milan is it's the depth that surprises you. Everyone, again, has talked about Ibrahimovic all season, and he's been brilliant. He's still a top scorer. But when Ibrahimovic isn't there, you're still looking at Ante Rebic, who's playing great, Hakan Çalhanoğlu, who after a couple of not great seasons is playing well for them, Leao, who's incredibly frustrating, but when he's on song, can dribble past players as well as anyone, probably the whole division. That midfield, they've got Sandro Tonali as well, who they're trying to bring on. He hasn't had such a great start, but he's thought of as one of the great development talents in Italian football. So it's the range of different, mostly young players. But it's that ensemble that is so surprising and impressive to me in this group. And I think at the top of it all, Stefano Pioli more than anything, because I think his job as manager has been incredible.
Talking about Italians loving managers who out-scheme their opposition, how scheming is Andrea Pirlo at the moment? Is he improving on his scheminess?
It's a good question. Juventus are obviously not top. They're 4 points off top, which is not where you ever expect Juventus to be. Results are feel like they're getting better. They did dump Parma 4-0 at the weekend. Game before that, they drew with Atalanta, but I would argue, wasn't it a strange game? Because it was almost one of their better team performances, but it was probably the worst performance I've seen out of Cristiano Ronaldo in a Juventus shirt, frankly. And the fact that he has a bad performance, they draw, the next game he's back on form and they win 4-0. Still sometimes feels a bit like the story with this Juventus team. Is Ronaldo A, available? Because he hasn't been for parts of the season. And is he going to show up? Because if he does, they'll probably win. That still feels a bit less about what Andrea Pirlo's doing and more about what Cristiano Ronaldo's doing, which is... feels a bit like, again, the trade that Juventus have made ever since they signed him. And most of the time it works out, because Ronaldo, in case you haven't heard, is quite good. I would say it feels like it's trending in a better direction for Pirlo. I think that it feels like there's something more coming together. I think he's identifying more what he wants from his midfield. There's a bit less chaos in this sort of early season when he was trying to just attack with five players. It was supposed to be a 3-2-5 in possession, and everyone was just treading on each other's feet. It feels like there's a bit less chaos there. And the other one, who I've been slightly reluctant to jump on this bandwagon, because I think we do this a lot, especially with certain countries' players, and I think we sometimes overreaction too quickly. But Weston McKennie, for me, is developing into something really important to the ability of that team to play the way Pirlo wants them to, because he is an aggressor. He is someone who goes and wins the ball for them up the field. He is someone who had some bite to that midfield, which I think they needed. So I think that his increasing role in the team has been significant for me in them looking more like a unit and less like these confused individuals.
Nikki, you said the question is whether or not Ronaldo will turn up. Is something happening with him? That sounds like he doesn't, because one thing about Ronaldo is he'll always compete. Is he disengaging in some way? Does he want out?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I certainly have no indication of that. And as I say, more often than not, he's been very good. Right. So I didn't mean that to sound like he's been a disaster. It's very fresh in the mind. So that game against Atalanta, he was very anonymous and he missed a penalty. It was a good save, to be fair, but he didn't score a penalty. And it does feel like there's still this sort of, reliance on him. If Ronaldo doesn't do it some games, then Juventus don't do it. And they've drawn more games than they should have in this part of the season. Partly, again, because there were games which he physically wasn't there for because of his coronavirus enforced pause.
Nikki, you mentioned Atalanta there. Will says, "What Papu Gomez, Atalanta, what exactly has he done? And will he be leaving in January? And if so, where would he fit in?"
This story breaks my heart. It really does. I've loved Papu Gomez at Atalanta over the last few years. I know where he is in the Guardian top 100 this year, but I can't say it yet because I don't think he's out there. So the story starts with actually exactly the theme that I was foreshadowing before about teams that are realizing they can't play the same way. Atalanta have played very intense high press a lot the last couple of seasons. And Gomez specifically has been playing in this tutto campista, literally sort of all over the pitch is what that means, role, because he is great at interpreting that role. He understands how to like take the right spaces and to work in ways that are difficult to track for opponents and which make the team much more unpredictable and mean that he can attack from different angles. And Gasperini reached a point this season, because Atalanta didn't start the season that well, where he turned around to Gomez and said, "Look, I can't have you doing this anymore. It's not good for you and it's not good for the team. You need to play in a more defined attacking role, closer to goal." And Gomez resisted it. And it seems like everything has broken down from there, basically. You've had this slightly odd on and off again situation where this story started to come out that there'd been an altercation between them in the dressing room. Then Gomez gets dropped. Then he comes back in for the critical game against Ajax in the Champions League and they win it. Then he's not in the team again. Then he's back in the squad to face Juventus and he comes off the bench and frankly is really important in turning that game around and getting them the draw. And then this weekend against Roma, he's fully out of the squad again. He's not even on the bench. So it's gone in these odd waves where it feels like Gasperini, the manager, has been maybe even a little bit cynical about it. Like he's made his decision that this is over. Or perhaps he feels that Gomez has, but he still called him in when he felt like he absolutely needed him. Against Roma this week, and he doesn't call him up. Atalanta start badly, Roma 1-0 up. And I was watching this game and thinking, God, he's going to regret this still. Gomez is still so important. But instead of Gomez coming off the bench this time, he brings off on Ilicic, who's been slowly, slowly finding his way back. He had a very difficult year, as a lot of people know. He had an amazing start to the season, then basically opted out of football for a while for some personal reasons, went home to Slovenia. He comes off the bench and absolutely takes the game over, sets up two goals, scores one goal, is incredible. And when you have Ilicic in that sort of form, you suddenly look around and go, oh, who needs Papu Gomez? I still have some reservations about that because Ilicic is a brilliant footballer. He's one of my favorite footballers to watch. I'm not sure I've ever believed that he's going to do it consistently over a whole season ever. I think he always sort of has these incredibly hot patches and then goes quiet for a bit. But it was a reminder that this Atalanta team has always kind of taken this view of, we're not one player. We'll let players go and we can build without them. They've done it over and over again. I mean, you think Kessié is one of the players they've let go. Gagliardini, who's at Inter, Mancini, the centre-back, they do it all the time and they usually get by. I still I'm in wait and see mode on that, because Gomez, he was the club captain. He was the face of the team. He was the guy who was the only one who could be that tutto campista and play all over the pitch when they wanted him to. We'll see. But it does certainly look like, from what he said and from what Gasperini's doing, this story is now over and he's going to be moving on this January.
And where could he be going?
So at the moment, we don't have a clear answer. There's certainly a lot of talk of him wanting to stay in Italy, and there are a lot of clubs in Italy who are interested, as you can imagine. Milan have been linked, Inter have been linked, Napoli have been linked, Roma have been linked. We will see, I think. There's no clear destination yet, but a lot of clubs are interested. And it does look like he wants to stay, certainly in Europe and ideally in Italy. After there was, of course, he was linked to move to Saudi Arabia, a very lucrative one in September, which he turned down. I think Gomez is still in the mindset where he wants to play in Europe and be a factor there.
And before we go to Lars's much anticipated Norwegian minute, is there anything you want to touch on to finish Serie A?
Only the ridiculousness that is Davide Ballardini taking the Genoa job again. It's the fourth time he's held that job. Genoa currently have three managers on their books. They still have Davide Nicola, who saved them from relegation last season. He's still being paid by them. Rolando Moran, who's just been sacked. They haven't really sacked him. They've done what they always do and said, all right, you're not the manager anymore. Keep picking up the wages. So they've got three managers. They've got one who's been there four times and they're currently on course for relegation. So yeah. It's a very Italian story at Genoa, I think.
Lars, Bodo Glimt. I still don't know how many teams that is. Tell me everything.
There's just one. No, we've talked about it before in the pod, but let's just sort of put the button on it. The Norwegian season, or their season, ended this weekend. They've played their 30 games, of which they've won 26, drawn 3, and lost just 1, scoring 103 games in the process. 103 goals, I should say, in 30 games. It's truly remarkable, made more remarkable by the fact that they've done so not on a big budget. I think their total salary budget this season is something like a third or a quarter of what Rosenborg are spending. So, I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. And there are a lot of factors, some of which are interesting, like there are players in the squad who've taken up meditation. They've hired a former fighter pilot as a sort of mentality coach. And then there's also more footballing stuff about how they play with a high press and they play the ball out from the back, which not a lot of teams in Norway do. But I just want to very quickly round up, sum up their season in just a couple of records they've set. And records they've set this season include, but are not limited to, most points ever, biggest points margin for a title winner, most wins ever, most points at home, most home wins, most consecutive home wins, most points away, most away wins, most goals scored ever, best ever goal difference, and first team to score in every game since the 16-team league format was introduced. I don't think we'll be seeing a season like this ever again, really, and it is truly, truly extraordinary.
Are you saying, Lars, that every team needs a maverick or an iceman in charge?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, look, well done to Bodo and well done to Glimt.
I mean, it's cheating, isn't it, playing two teams? I mean, of course, you have to win every game.
It really has looked that way in a few games, like they have their two teams out there.
When they play Dagenham and Redbridge, we'll find out who the best are. Mick says, finally, for Sid, how much ham do you have for Christmas?
Well, funnily enough, we've been interrupted. I believe it's now three times on this podcast as people have been coming to the door. I'm expecting a delivery today of pork-based products.
Marvellous. That's all we needed to know. Put it in the ham garage, and one day we'll come over and do a pod from Spain when we're allowed out of this godforsaken country. Anyway, on that happy note, thank you so much for your time, Sid. Have a good Christmas.
Pleasure, and you.
Cheers, Nikki, and to you.
Happy Christmas.
Lars and Barry will join me and Jonathan Wilson for a drunken Christmas special tomorrow, and we'll bring you that on Christmas Eve.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.